and so, often passionately interested in these manifold investigations and introspections, they are actually very busy and hardly notice their solitude. I have never heard a Tibetan hermit say that, even at the beginning of his retreat, he had suffered from lack of associations with men. Generally, those who have tasted the anchorite life find it difficult, if not impossible, to resume life among other people or to enjoy regular social intercourse. Whatever those unacquainted with it may think, solitude and utter loneliness are far from being devoid of charm. Words cannot convey the almost voluptuous sweetness of the feelings experienced when one closes the door of one's tsumzkang, or when one looks down from the heights at the first wintry snow heaping up in the lower valleys, creating for months around the hermitage an impassable white and cold rampart. But, most likely, only those who have lived through it themselves can understand the irresistible attraction that hermit life exerts on many Orientals. The practices to which Tibetan recluses apply themselves while shut in their tsumzkang or retreats are many and of a various nature. Any attempt to compile a complete list of them would be vain, for most probably nobody in the world knows them all. One finds in the Tibetan mystic literature more or less exhaustive descriptions of a few practices, but, as a rule, they are reticent on the points which interest us most, that is to say the purpose of the practices. Reliable information can only be obtained from those who are acquainted with traditional oral teaching for each particular exercise. One must, especially, beware of remaining satisfied with interpretations obtained of only one initiate, for they vary not only among different sects, but among individual teachers. It would be a mistake to fancy that all Tibetans who live in seclusion in a tsumzkang or betake themselves to solitude, are endowed with uncommon intelligence and ponder over transcendental problems. I have already spoken of the Sham Gomjans who have taken to religious life as to a profession. There also exists a very large number of well-meaning simpletons and men of average mental power who bring the superstitions of popular Lamaism to their retreat. Amongst those, many devote the time of their seclusion repeating thousands and even millions of times one single formula, generally a Sanskrit mantra which is unintelligible to them. Others recite a Tibetan text, but often they understand no more of its meaning than if they were uttering words in a foreign language. The most ordinary formula is the well-known Om Mani Padme Hum. I say, well-known as far as the words are concerned, because foreigners have read it in many books. It does not follow that its meaning has been made clear to them. Lay travelers and even Orientalists are sometimes a little too quick to declare that meaningless which they do not at once understand. Erudite authors, even today, translate the first word of the formula, Om, by our commonplace exclamation Ah, and Hum, the last word, by Amen. There exists an immense literature in India devoted to the explanation of the mystic word Om. The latter has exoteric, esoteric and mystic meanings. It may signify the three persons of the Hindu Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. It may signify the Brahman, the one without a second of the Advaita philosophy. It stands as a symbol of the inexpressible absolute, the last word to be uttered in mysticism, after which there follows only silence. It is, according to Sri Sankaracharya, the support of the meditation, or, as declared in the Mundaka Upanishad's text itself, it is the bow by the means of which the individual self attains the universal self. Again, Om is the creative sound whose vibrations build the worlds. When the mystic is capable of hearing all in one the countless voices, cries, songs, and noises of all beings and things that exist and move, it is the unique sound Om which reaches him. That same Om vibrates also in the utmost depth of his inner self. He who can pronounce it with the right tone, is able to work wonders, and he who knows how to utter it silently, attains supreme emancipation. Tibetans who have received the word Om from India together with the mantras with which it is associated, do not appear to have been acquainted with its many meanings among their southern neighbors, nor do they know the very prominent place it occupies in their religions and philosophies. Om is repeated by Lamaists along with other Sanskrit formulas, without having a special importance by itself, while other mystic syllables as Hum, and especially Fat, are supposed to possess great power and are much used in magic and mystic rites. So much for the first word of the formula. Manipadma, Sanskrit terms that mean jewel in the lotus. Here we come, it seems, to an immediately intelligible meaning, yet the current interpretation does not take any account of that plain meaning. Common folk believe that the recitation of Om Mani Padme Hum will assure them a happy rebirth in Nubduar Chen, the western paradise of the great bliss. The more learned have been told that the six syllables of the formula are connected with the six classes of sentient beings and are related to one of the mystic colors as follows. Om is white and connected with gods, La. Ma is blue and connected with non-gods, La. Ma and A. A kind of titans always at war with the gods. A. N is yellow and connected with men, Mi. Pad is green and connected with animals, Tudo. Mi is red and connected with non-men, Yidag. B. The bodies of Yidags are as big as a hill, their necks are as thin as a thread. These miserable beings are perpetually tortured by hunger and thirst. When they approach water to drink, it transforms itself into flame. Every morning the lamas offer consecrated water to the Yidags to relieve their sufferings. This consecrated water does not turn into flame at their approach, or other Mimayin. In the Mimayin class are included demigods, genii, spirits of various kind, either friendly or malevolent. B. Hum is black and connected with dwellers in purgatories. There are several opinions regarding the effect of the recitation of these six syllables. Popular tradition declares that those who frequently repeat the formula will be reborn in the western paradise of the great bliss. Others who deem themselves more enlightened declare that the recitation of Om Mani Padme Hum may liberate from a rebirth in any of the six realms. Om Mani Padme Hum is used as a support for a special meditation which may, approximately, be described as follows. 1. Identifies the six kinds of beings with the six syllables which are pictured in their respective colors, as mentioned above. They form a kind of chain without end that circulates through the body, carried on by the breath, entering through one nostril and going out through the other. As the concentration of mind becomes more perfect, one sees mentally the length of the chain increasing. Now when they go out with the expiration, the mystic syllables are carried far away, before being absorbed again with the next inspiration. Yet, the chain is not broken, it rather elongates like a rubber strap and always remains in touch with the man who meditates. Gradually, also, the shape of the Tibetan letters vanishes and those who obtain the fruit of the practice perceived the six syllables as six realms in which arise, move, enjoy, suffer, and pass away the innumerable beings belonging to the six species. And now it remains for the meditator to realize that the six realms, the whole phenomenal world, are subjective, a mere creation of the mind which imagines them and into which they sink. Advanced mystics reach, by the way of this practice, a trance in which the letters of the formula, as well as the beings and their activity, all merge into that which, for lack of a better term, Mahayanist Buddhists have called emptiness. Then, having realized the void, they become emancipated from the illusion of the world and, as a consequence, liberated from rebirths which are but the fruit of that creative delusion. Another of the many interpretations of Om Mani Padme Hum ignores the division in six syllables and takes the formula according to its meaning, a jewel in a lotus. These words are considered as symbolic. The simplest interpretation is, in the lotus exists the precious jewel of Buddha's teaching. Another explanation takes the lotus as the mind. In the depth of it, by introspective meditation, one is able to find the jewel of knowledge, truth, reality, liberation, nirvana, these various terms being different denominations of one same thing. Now we come to a meaning related to certain doctrines of the Mahayanist Buddhists. According to them, nirvana, the supreme salvation, is not separated from samsara, the phenomenal world, but the mystic finds the first in the heart of the second, just as the jewel may be found in the lotus. Nirvana, the jewel exists when enlightenment exists. Samsara, the lotus, exists when illusion exists, which veils nirvana, just as the many petals of the lotus conceal the jewel nestling among them. hum. At the end of the formula, is a mystic expression of wrath used in coercing fierce deities and subduing demons. How has it become affixed to the jewel in the lotus and the Indian orm? Dash, this again is explained in various ways. Hum. Is a kind of mystic war cry, uttering it, is challenging an enemy. Who is the enemy? Each one imagines him in his own way, either as powerful fiends, or as the trinity of bad propensities that bind us to the round of rebirth, namely lust, hatred and stupidity. More subtle thinkers see him as the eye. Hum. Is also said to mean the mind devoid of objective content, etc. Another syllable is added to conclude the repetition of Om Mani Padme Hum. 108 times on the beads of a rosary. It is the syllable re. Some understand it as signifying an inner reality hidden under the appearances, the basic essence of things. Beside Om Mani Padme Hum Re. Other formulas are also repeated as Om Vajra Sattva. That is to say, Om Most Excellent, Diamond, Being. It is understood that the Excellent One meant is the Buddha. The followers of the Red Cap sects often repeat, Om Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum, as praise of their founder Padmasambhava. These words mean Om, Most Excellent Powerful Guru Padma, Miracle Worker, Hum. Amongst longer formulas, one of the most popular is that called Kayabdo. It is Tibetan without admixture of Sanskrit and its significance is plain, yet far from crude. The text runs as follows. I take refuge in all holy refuges. Ye fathers and mothers, ancestors, who are wandering in the round of rebirths under the shapes of the six kinds of sentient beings. In order to attain Buddhahood, the state devoid of fear and sorrow, let your thoughts be directed towards enlightenment. Often this formula is given to beginners for the first period of tsams. Its words are well known and anyone can repeat them without being shut in tsams. They are held as meritorious and efficacious under any circumstance. For this reason, I had chosen them during my journey to Lhasa, to break the monotonous repetition of Om Mani Padme Hum. When I deemed it prudent to appear absorbed in a pious exercise to avoid annoying talks and embarrassing questions that might have put my incognito in jeopardy. The common Kayabdo, tsams consists in remaining in seclusion in a hut or in one's own room and repeating the above-mentioned formula 100,000 times, while prostrating oneself the same number of times. Any formula may be repeated in the same way, with 100,000 prostrations. Tibetans perform prostrations in two ways. One is very much like the Chinese kowtow. The difference is that before kneeling, one lifts the arms above the head, joining the palms, and then brings the folded hands successively in front of the forehead, the mouth and the heart. Obeisances of that kind are repeated three times when saluting the images in the temples, the lamas of rank, one's own guru, and the sacred books or edifices. The second kind of prostration is called Kyangshag. It is made in Indian fashion, the body lying flat on the ground, and is only performed in a few special very devotional exercises such as the Kayabdo practice. Tsamspas, who aspire to the title of Shagbam, repeat 100,000 times a Kayabdo formula while prostrating themselves as many times, their foreheads actually touching the ground or the floor of the room at each prostration. This repeated contact of the flesh with a hard surface produces a bump or even a sore. The latter must show certain peculiarities understood by experts in the matter, which indicate whether the object of the rite has, or has not, been obtained. Tsamspas, who consider themselves far above the practice of Kayabdo, perform breathing exercises. These consist in taking different, often extraordinary, postures while one trains oneself to inhale, exhale, hold the breath in and keep it out in various ways. Often the tsamspas drill themselves naked, and the shape of the belly during the exercises is a sign that shows the degree of proficiency attained by the disciple. Beside physical results, some of which have been described in a preceding chapter, Tibetans affirm that through mastery over breath one may conquer all passion and anger as well as carnal desires, acquire serenity, prepare the mind for meditation and awake spiritual energy. Breath is the courser and mind is the rider, say the Tibetan mystics. So it is essential that the courser must be well trained. But breath, in its turn, influences bodily and mental activity. Consequently, two methods have been devised, the most easy one which quiets the mind by controlling the breath and the more difficult way which consists in regulating the breath by controlling the mind. To the breathing drill repeated several times each day, the recluse often adds the contemplative meditation practiced with kayak haws. Kayak haws are diagrams drawn on paper or material, or engraved on stone, metal or wood. Others are constructed with small flags, altar lamps, incense sticks and vases containing various things such as grain, water, etc. The personalities who are supposed to dwell in the kayaka and their requisites are represented by pyramidal cakes named torma. Kayak haws are also drawn with color powders on the temple floor or on boards. I have seen some which measured about 7 feet in diameter. The word kayaka means a circle. Nevertheless, amongst the numberless kinds of kayak haws, there exist square and quadrangular forms, while those used in black magic or for the coercion or destruction of malignant entities are triangular. The monks who wish to become proficient in this kind of art spend years studying its rules. One of the four high colleges which exist in all large monasteries teaches the art of drawing the kayak haws that are parts of the official Lamaist magic rites. As for secret ones connected with mystic training or black magic, each student must learn them privately from his own teacher. The least mistake in the drawing of a kayaka or the place given to the tormas in its construction, may have most terrible consequences, for the kayaka is a magic instrument which hurts him who handles it unskillfully. Moreover, no one should construct or draw a kayaka if he has not been empowered to do so, by a proper initiation, and each variety of kayaka requires the corresponding initiation. That which is the work of a non-initiated cannot be animated and remains powerless. As for the true understanding of the symbolic meaning of the kayak haws, and the theories which support their use in psychic training, very few are aware of them. Needless to say that elaborate and large-sized kayak haws cannot find room in the tsums kangs. Their form, there, is very much simplified. At the beginning of his spiritual education, the novice is likely to be taught by his teacher the way of constructing a diagram which is to be used as support to fix the attention during meditation. One of the exercises most generally practiced, either with or without a kayaka, at that stage of the training, is the following: a deity is imagined, it is first contemplated alone, then from its body spring out other forms sometimes like its own, sometimes different. There are often four of them, but in some meditations they become hundreds or even innumerable. When all these personages have appeared quite clearly around the central figure, they are one after another reabsorbed in it. Now the original deity remains again alone and gradually begins to disappear. The feet vanish first and then slowly the whole body and finally the head. Only a dot remains. This may be dark, colored or purely luminous. Mystic masters interpret this as a sign which shows the degree of spiritual progress attained by their disciples. Then, the dot moves towards the man who beholds it and sinks into him. One must note the part of the body in which it seems to disappear. A period of meditation follows that exercise, which may be done again and again as many times as desired. One may also imagine a lotus. It opens slowly and on each of its petals stands a bodhisattva, one of them being enthroned in the heart of the flower. After a while, as the lotus begins to fold its petals again, each one emits a ray of light that sinks into the center of the flower, and when it closes entirely, light escapes from its heart and penetrates the man in meditation. There exist many kinds of similar practices. Many novices do not proceed farther. Thus dryly described, such visions cannot but appear absurd, yet they constitute a somewhat fascinating puzzle on account of the multifarious unexpected aspects they assume after a certain time of training. They provide the recluse with spectacles which rival the most beautiful fairy plays that can be seen on the stage. Even those who are well aware of their elusive nature may enjoy them, and as for those who believe in the reality of the divine players, it is not surprising that they are bewitched. However, It is not to amuse the hermits that these exercises have been invented. Their true aim is to lead the disciple to understand that the worlds and all phenomena which we perceive are but mirages born from our imagination. They emanate from the mind and into the mind they sink. In fact, this is the fundamental teaching of Tibetan mystics. If we now consider the case of a monk ventures to solicit the teaching of a contemplative anchorite Nalgyopa, the training takes another aspect. Methods become strange, sometimes even cruel. We have seen it in a previous chapter. The trilogy, examination, meditation, understanding, takes a peculiar importance among the followers of the short path, and the intellectual activity of the disciple is exclusively directed towards these results. Sometimes the means that are used seem extravagant, yet when closely investigated one sees that the object aimed at is quite reasonable. It is also clear that inventors of these curious methods perfectly understand the mind of their brethren in religion and have devised them accordingly. Padmasambhava is said to have described the stages of the mystic path in the following way. 1. To read a large number of books on the various religions and philosophies. To listen to many learned doctors professing different doctrines. To experiment oneself with a number of methods. 2. To choose a doctrine among the many one has studied and discard the other ones, as the eagle carries off only one sheep from the flock. 3. To remain in a lowly condition, humble in one's demeanor, not seeking to be conspicuous or important in the eyes of the world, but behind apparent insignificance, to let one's mind soar high above all worldly power and glory. 4. To be indifferent to all. Behaving like the dog or the pig that eat what chance brings them, not making any choice among the things which one meets, abstaining from any effort to acquire or avoid anything, accepting with an equal indifference whatever comes, riches or poverty, praise or contempt, giving up the distinction between virtue and vice, honorable and shameful, good and evil, being neither afflicted, nor repenting whatever one may have done and, on the other hand, never being elated nor proud on account of what one has accomplished. 5. To consider with perfect equanimity and detachment the conflicting opinions and the various manifestations of the activity of beings. To understand that such is the nature of things, the inevitable mode of action of each entity, and to remain always serene. To look at the world as a man standing on the highest mountain of the country looks at the valleys and the lesser summits spread out below him. 6. It is said that the sixth stage cannot be described in words. It corresponds to the realization of the void which, in Lamaist terminology, means the inexpressible reality. In spite of these programs, it is impossible to establish a regular gradation of the multifarious training exercises devised by Tibetan mystic anchorites. In practice, these various exercises are combined. Moreover, each lama adopts a peculiar method, and it is even rare to see two disciples of the same master following exactly the same path. We must make up our minds to accept an apparent chaos which is a natural result of the different individual tendencies and aptitudes which the gurus, adepts of the short path, refuse to crush. Liberty is the motto on the heights of the land of snows, but strangely enough, the disciple starts on that road of utter freedom, by the strictest obedience to his spiritual guide. However, the required submission is confined to the spiritual and psychic exercises and the way of living prescribed by the master. No dogmas are ever imposed. The disciple may believe, deny or doubt anything according to his own feelings. I have heard a lama say that the part of a master, adept of the short path, is to superintend a clearing. He must incite the novice to rid himself of the beliefs, ideas, acquired habits and innate tendencies, which are part of his present mind, and have been developed in the course of successive lives whose origin is lost in the night of time. On the other hand, the master must warn his disciple to be on his guard against accepting new beliefs, ideas and habits as groundless and irrational as those which he shakes off. The discipline on the short path is to avoid imagining things. When imagination is prescribed, in contemplative meditation, it is to demonstrate by that conscious creation of perceptions or sensations, the illusory nature of those perceptions and sensations which we accept as real, though they too rest on imagination, the only difference being that, in their case, the creation is unconsciously affected. The Tibetan reformer, Tsongkhapa, defines meditation as the means of enabling oneself to reject all imaginative thoughts together with their seed. It is this uprooting of the present imaginative thoughts, and the burning of their seed, so that no fanciful ideas may arise in the future, that constitutes the clearing which I have just mentioned. Two exercises are especially prescribed by the adepts of the mystic path. The first consists in observing with great attention the workings of the mind without attempting to stop it. He marks the spontaneous arising of ideas, memories, desires, etc., and considers how, superseded by new ones, they sink into the dark recesses of the mind. He watches also the subjective image, which, apparently unconnected with any thoughts or sensations, appears while his eyes are closed, men, animals, landscapes, moving crowds, etc. During that exercise, he avoids making reflections about the spectacle which he beholds, looking passively at the continual, swift, flowing stream of thoughts and mental images that whirl, jostle, fight and pass away. It is said that the disciple is about to gather the fruit of this practice when he loosens the firm footing he had kept, till then, in his quality of spectator. He too, so he must understand, is an actor on the tumultuous stage. His present introspection, all his acts and thoughts, and the very sum of them all which he calls his self, are but ephemeral bubbles in a whirlpool made of an infinite quantity of bubbles which congregate for a moment, separate, burst, and form again, following a giddy rhythm. The second exercise is intended to stop the roaming of the mind in order that one may concentrate it on one single object. Training which tends to develop a perfect concentration of mind is generally deemed necessary for all students without distinction. As to observing the mind's activity, it is only recommended to the most intellectual disciples. Training the mind to one-pointedness is practiced in all Buddhist sects. In southern Buddhist countries, Ceylon, Siam, Burma, an apparatus called kusinas, which consists of clay discs variously colored, or a round surface covered by water, or a fire at which one gazes through a screen in which a round hole is pierced, are used for this purpose. Any of these circles is stared at until it is seen as clearly when the eyes are shut, as when they are open and actually looking at it. The process does not aim at producing an hypnotic state, as some Western scholars have said, but it accustoms one to concentrating the mind. The fact that the subjective image has become as vivid as the objective, indicates—according to those who patronize that method—that one-pointedness has been reached. Tibetans consider the object chosen to train oneself to be of no importance. Whatever attracts and retains most easily the thoughts of the disciple should be preferred. There is a story well known in the Tibetan religious world which illustrates a successful result of this practice. A young man begs the spiritual guidance of a mystic anchorite. The latter wishes him to begin by exercising himself in the concentration of mind. "What kind of work do you usually do?" he inquires of his new disciple. "I keep the yaks. Yak, spelt Jayak, the Tibetan wild hairy ox that has been domesticated, on the hills," answered the man. "All right," says the Gomchen. "Meditate on a yak." The novice repairs to a cave roughly fitted up to serve as a habitation. A few such shelters can always be found in the regions inhabited by herdsmen, and settles down there. After some time, the master goes to the place and calls to his pupil to come out of the cave. The latter hears the Gomchen's voice, gets up and wants to walk out through the entrance of his primitive dwelling. But his meditation has achieved its purpose. He has identified himself with the object on which all his thoughts have been concentrated. He has forgotten his own personality. He feels himself a yak. Now, though the opening is large enough to allow the passage of a man, it is too narrow for a big bull. So, while struggling against an imaginary obstacle, the young man answered his guru, "I cannot get out. My horns prevent me." Though deeply respectful of everything connected with religion, Tibetans always retain a keen sense of humor. They do not fail to notice the comic effect that such practices produce when performed by simple-minded novices. The following story was told me in the course of a tramp with an Aljorpa from Gartok.